Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Ready? Okay. Give me a beach.
Beach.
Give me great food.
Tacos.
Give me adventure.
Hiking.
Give me a date night.
Sunset cruise.
Give me some smiles.
Cheese.
Give me more beaches.
Beaches.
What's that spell?
San Diego.
If you're happy and you know it, San Diego is the place to show it. Book your trip at sandiego.org. Funded in part with the City of San Diego Tourism Marketing District Assessment Funds.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
A city gripped by a toxic cloud.
It just continues to get worse and worse. It just doesn't seem to be clearing at all.
A pinball wizard plays the game of a lifetime.
He knew that everything was going to rest on this decision.
And a terrifying group of masked marauders.
Masked men under cover of darkness set the barn on fire.
Inside the walls of great institutions lie extraordinary relics. Tales of intrigue and wonder, and secrets waiting to be revealed. These are the mysteries at the museum.
St. Louis, Missouri is famously home to the 630-foot-tall Gateway Arch, a monument to the city's status as a point of departure for westward pioneers. And perhaps no institution celebrates its history as a transit hub better than the Museum of Transportation. Located on its sprawling grounds is a 1941 Big Boy steam engine, the first Missouri River towboat with a welded steel hull, and the largest diesel-powered rotary snowplow ever built. But inside its archives is one smaller artifact that seems utterly out of its depth.
It's an irregularly shaped object. It's about 20 inches long and it's along its point. It's made of plastic and metal in red, yellow, and blue. It kind of looks like a toy.
But as author Andrew Ruzicki reveals, this colorful contraption was inspired by a very serious event.
Its origins are a tale of craftsmanship, courage, and creativity at the height of the Cold War.
What is this curious device? And how was it born from a desperate bid for freedom? 1966, East Germany. Long after they were isolated from the democratic West, residents of this communist state are under the control of an oppressive regime.
Life behind the Iron Curtain was one of scarcity. Food was rationed, travel was restricted, and citizens lived under constant fear of the government.
But in the seaside province of Mecklenburg, a 26-year-old chemical engineer named Bernd Betker envisions a better future in the West.
Bernd is curious, he's young, and he's motivated, but mostly he dreams of freedom.
But there's one thing that stands in his way. East Germany's tightly controlled border, an 836-mile stretch of land with a terrifying reputation.
It was nicknamed the Death Strip. Bernd knew chances of crossing it were impossible.
But one evening, while walking along the shore of the Baltic Sea, Betker spies something that gives him hope.
In the horizon, he sees a gleaming beacon of light.
The signal belongs to the Getzer, a Danish lightship permanently anchored 15 miles offshore to guide vessels around a rocky island. And it gives Betker an idea.
In that moment, a light bulb went off in his head. He reasons that if he can't escape by land, perhaps he could flee by sea.
Metker believes that if he can make it to the Gedser, the crew would have to accept him as a political refugee. But getting there won't be easy.
This area, like every other area in East Germany, was under constant surveillance. He knows that a rowboat or a raft would be immediately spotted.
The only way to avoid being seen is to stay as close to the surface of the water as possible. But the distance is too great to swim. So Metker decides to build something that can help. Laboring tirelessly for 8 months, he constructs a small machine that will tow him across the water.
Using just about anything he could find, Byrne designs a device made of a fiberglass tank and a bicycle motor. It was about the size of a briefcase and resembled a tiny torpedo.
But before he attempts his escape, the engineer needs to test his machine. So, in the middle of the night, Metker carries it to the beach and furtively slips into the sea.
Starts the engine, and slowly but surely, it begins to tow him through the water. This is all the proof Byrne needs. His device works.
But suddenly, a blinding spotlight pierces the darkness. He looks up to see an East German police boat bearing down on him.
Byrne's hopes turn to crippling fear.
Metker is fished out of the water and brought back to shore. He is convicted of attempting an illegal border crossing and sent to prison.
Byrne's dreams are shattered.
Metker languishes behind bars. But after 3 months, a surprising development breathes new life into his dreams of escape.
The East German government realizes that his skills as a chemical technician are far too valuable for Byrne to be in prison. So they set him free.
And as soon as he's released, he immediately begins building a new and improved escape device.
Having learned from his mistakes from the first attempt, he realizes that the only way for him to escape is to be invisible. He has to stay below the surface of the water.
This time, Metker will use weights to keep him completely submerged beneath the surface. And to help him breathe, he adopts a simple solution.
He decides to use a snorkel.
Finally, on September 8, 1968, he takes to the water once again. If he's caught this time, he'll face execution.
This is his last shot.
Metker sinks below the water, with just the tip of the small dark snorkel piercing the surface. The young man remains underwater for an entire hour. And when he finally emerges to check his progress, it appears that his covert plan has succeeded.
There are no engines, there are no lights, there are no patrols. It looks like he's in the clear.
Metker lets his device tow him for another 10 miles. 4 hours later, he's spotted by the surprised crew of the Gedser and pulled aboard.
After years of hoping and dreaming and tinkering with his device, Byrne has finally made it to freedom.
News of Metker's incredible escape makes headlines around the world. But the story of his ingenious invention doesn't end there.
Byrne receives a phone call from a businessman about commercializing his technology.
In 1978, a small watercraft called the Aqua Scooter, based on Metker's original design, makes its debut in sporting goods stores across Europe and America. Made of lightweight plastic and powered by a small motor, it allows everyone from kids to diving enthusiasts to explore the depths.
The device is an instant hit.
Today, this Aqua Scooter, in the collection of the Museum of Transportation in St. Louis, recalls one man's innovative escape and the unlikely origins of a fun underwater activity.
San Diego, California has a rich maritime heritage. It is home to the world's oldest active sailing ship, the Star of India, which was built in 1863.
But further inland is an institution dedicated to a different facet of this city's past, the San Diego Public Library. This 9-floor building contains more than just classic literature. It houses a collection of jazz music, historic baseball memorabilia, and a guest ledger from San Diego's Horton Hotel, which opened in 1886. But deep inside this repository is an artifact that left a black cloud hanging over local lore.
This is a wooden box, about a foot in length, and there are little metal cups attached by chains, and there's a series of little weights that appears to be at the bottom.
As Special Collections Supervisor Richard Crawford tells it, this apparatus is connected to one of the worst natural disasters in the city's history.
These scales were used by a man who promised to control Mother Nature.
What role did these scales play in a thunderous event that nearly wiped San Diego off the map? 1915, San Diego. This seaside paradise is in the midst of an unprecedented crisis. A five-year drought has water supplies dwindling to perilously low levels. And nowhere is the problem more apparent than 60 miles east of the city, where the massive Lake Morena Reservoir sits nearly empty.
San Diego had a real urgent problem.
And it's amidst this tense atmosphere that on December 8th, a charismatic salesman named Charles Hatfield arrives at City Hall.
Charles Hatfield was well-dressed, and when he talked to people, he came across almost as a professor.
Hatfield tells city council members that he has a unique solution to San Diego's water woes. He can make it rain.
Hatfield claimed he had the tools and the know-how to produce rain from clouds.
Hatfield explains that by releasing his own secret mixture of chemicals into the atmosphere, he can generate a storm. And he makes a tantalizing proposal.
He offers to fill Morena full to the brim, and he would do it within 1 year's time for $10,000.
And to seal the deal, he offers an irresistible guarantee.
If the rain came, he would be paid. If not, there was no payment.
With nothing to lose, the councilmen eagerly accept Hatfield's offer. In early January, Hatfield sets up camp on the edge of Lake Morena. There, he measures out his secret potion, using the same scales on display at the San Diego Public Library.
Hatfield would mix his chemicals, and these would be ignited, and smoke would waft into the atmosphere.
Then, just a few days later, it seems his efforts have worked.
January 10th starts to rain, and it rains pretty well for the next several days.
To Hatfield's delight, the downpour continues for two straight weeks.
He's got to be very excited about this because his contract is going to be fulfilled very, very quickly.
And on January 27th, less than 1 month after beginning his task, Lake Morena is full. Confident in a job well done, Hatfield heads back to San Diego to collect his paycheck. But as he approaches the city, he finds the deluge has had a devastating result. The rain has caused widespread flooding and washed away critical bridges. But that's not all. The sudden downpour caused the massive Sweetwater Dam to burst, unleashing a flood that nearly destroyed San Diego.
The devastation was unparalleled.
So has Hatfield's secret formula worked too well?
In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com and get up to 15% off your first purchase as a member with code REBAGNEW. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAGNEW for up to 15% off your first purchase as a member.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Ready? Okay. Give me a beach.
Beach!
Give me great food.
Tacos!
Give me adventure.
Hiking.
Give me a date night.
Sunset cruise.
Give me some smiles.
Cheese.
Give me more beaches.
Beaches.
What's that spell?
San Diego.
If you're happy and you know it, San Diego is the place to show it. Book your trip at sandiego.org. Funded in part with the City of San Diego Tourism Marketing District Assessment Funds.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
It's 1916. The city of San Diego is in the midst of a terrible drought. Civic leaders are so desperate, they turn to a charismatic salesman named Charles Hatfield, who claims he can make it rain. Indeed, Hatfield's efforts seem to work too well, unleashing a deluge that wipes out bridges and floods farms and buildings. So did Charles Hatfield really summon a storm?
When Hatfield returns to City Hall, officials claim that the flood caused over $3.5 million in damage and refuse to pay the rainmaker. Hatfield is incredulous and demands compensation.
He had been hired to produce rain, and he'd done his job. The collateral damage, if you will, was not his responsibility.
Despite his protests, Hatfield is never paid. After the flood, the rainmaker continues to offer his services around the country, until the Great Depression puts him out of business entirely. And in 1958, Charles Hatfield passes away, taking his secret formula to the grave. But the question remains, could Charles Hatfield actually control Mother Nature? Some skeptics contend that the storm that flooded San Diego was simply coincidental. Others argue that Hatfield was a savvy charlatan who was skilled in meteorology. By predicting a coming storm, he could waltz into town in advance, offer his services for a hefty fee, and claim success when the rain fell.
He came here in the wintertime, when rain does naturally occur.
But some believe Hatfield's methods had similarities to a more recent scientific innovation known as cloud seeding.
There are means of producing rain from clouds by using chemicals.
Officially developed in the 1940s, cloud seeding can create small amounts of rain by vaporizing substances such as silver iodide and dry ice, the same chemicals Hatfield used. While not powerful enough to create a storm in its own right, Hatfield's efforts might have strengthened one that was already bearing down on the city. To this day, the event is known in San Diego lore as Hatfield's Flood. And this set of scales at the San Diego Public Library recalls a controversial man and his curious blend of chemistry, meteorology, and salesmanship. Hopkinsville, Kentucky is named for Samuel Hopkins, a U.S. congressman who served under General George Washington during the Revolutionary War. Today, the region's history is housed here at the Penny Royal Area Museum. Its eclectic collection includes a cash register from the historic Latham Hotel, a local magician's ventriloquist dummy, and items relating to psychic Edgar Casey, who was born in Hopkinsville in 1877. But amidst these items is one that speaks to a dark chapter in this town's past.
It is made of black cloth with four holes, with red material stitched around those holes. This object is approximately 100 years old or older.
According to historian William T. Turner, this sinister-looking artifact spawned a tale of secrecy, violence, and mayhem.
This mask created a reign of terror in the minds and hearts of people across this area.
Who were the shadowy figures behind this mask?
1906. Tobacco is a booming business across the country, and nowhere is that more true than in the communities along the Kentucky-Tennessee border.
its farmers take special pride in their unique strand of the crop, which is renowned for its rich flavor and unusually dark hue.
Dark tobacco is a very dark green. So dark green, in fact, that in the bright sunlight, it appears black. The area was known as the Black Patch.
But despite the high demand for their Black Patch tobacco, many farmers make just a meager living. Most of their crop is sold at low prices to the monopolistic American Tobacco Company, run by the North Carolina mogul, James Buck Duke.
Buck Duke was getting such a large supply that he could pay them what he damn well chose to pay them.
But on December 10th, a factory owner named Jim Chestnut finds he has something far more important to worry about than tobacco prices. He is awoken by the clamor of strange voices. Then he smells smoke. When Chestnut looks through his window, he is horrified.
Masked men, under cover of darkness, set the warehouse on fire.
Chestnut watches helplessly as his barn, filled with 3,000 pounds of tobacco, goes up in flames. And Jim Chestnut is not alone. In the coming months, tobacco fields across the region are set ablaze in the dead of night. With each fire, a description of the men responsible comes into sharper focus. Witnesses report seeing groups wearing black and red masks, like this one on display at the Pennyroyal Area Museum. These nefarious figures become known by a terrifying moniker, the Night Riders. Finally, the fear wrought by these marauders reaches a fever pitch.
In the early morning hours of Saturday, December 7th, 1907, masked men entered Hopkinsville from the west. This group had come to town to burn the tobacco warehouses.
In a matter of minutes, $500,000 in tobacco goes up in flames. The shocking episode makes headlines across the country. And the governor of Kentucky calls in the National Guard to combat the scourge.
Something was going to have to be done.
Law enforcement fans out across the Black Patch, searching for anyone with ties to the mysterious Night Riders. But shockingly, when members of the gang are rounded up in 1910, they share a surprising profession. They are all local tobacco farmers. But why would the men commit such brazen crimes against their fellow farmers? It is soon revealed that the group initially intended to protest the monopolistic practices of none other than Buck Duke and his American Tobacco Company.
Members of the Night Riders were disgruntled farmers, upset over the low price they were getting for their dark tobacco.
Fed up, the men formed their own group, the Planters Protective Association, to lobby for a higher share of the company's profits. But as they tried to recruit supporters, some farmers, fearing reprisal from Buck Duke, refused to join. So a splinter group was formed, and it used fear and intimidation against those who declined to help in the fight against the American Tobacco Company.
They traveled under the cover of darkness to coerce non-cooperating farmers to join the Tobacco Association.
When alleged members of the Night Riders are brought to trial for arson, none are willing to break their code of silence.
Every Night Rider, with right hand raised and left hand on God's word, had sworn that he would forever conceal and never reveal the secrets of this order.
When the case goes to the jury of 12 men, 11 of whom are farmers, there is little surprise that the verdict comes back not guilty. While no one faces punishment for the destruction, the events attract the attention of the federal government, which finally ends Buck Duke's monopoly.
In 1911, suit was filed against the American Tobacco Trust in violation of the Sherman Antitrust Act, and the trust was dissolved, and the Night Rider era was over.
Today, at the Pennyroyal Area Museum, this mask recalls a clandestine gang of men and the terror that inflamed a small Kentucky community. The Bay Area city of Alameda, California, is home to the historic Alameda Theater, which opened in 1932 and is considered a jewel of Art Deco design. But it's also the site of a unique institution dedicated to a specific slice of American history, the Pacific Pinball Museum. Its exhibits include playable classics, a one-of-a-kind see-through machine, and a rare 1871 Parlor Bagatelle, the first game to receive a pinball patent. But among these carefree relics is one device that represents scandal and controversy.
The artifact is about 2 feet wide, 5 feet deep, and about 4 feet high. It's made out of wood, metal, and glass, and has an Art Deco theme painted on the outside.
As founder Michael Shees tells it, a machine like this was wrapped up in a political firestorm that left one man fighting to keep the game alive.
This is a story of a true pinball wizard and his quest to save pinball in a rather unorthodox way.
How did a dramatic stunt rescue a popular American pastime? 1970, Madison, Wisconsin. Roger Sharp is studying business at the University of Wisconsin, but every spare moment is devoted to his greatest passion, pinball.
Roger Sharp happened to be a very good pinball player.
Sharp has spent 4 years playing in campus bars. But when he moves to New York City after graduation, he finds something stands in the way of his favorite activity. Pinball is illegal in the Big Apple. Over 30 years earlier, in 1942, then-Mayor Fiorella LaGuardia outlawed pinball. Since some machines offered cash payouts, LaGuardia considered it no different than a game of chance, on par with notorious gambling devices like slot machines. And that, along with one key design feature, made the association with gambling impossible to shake.
Unlike modern pinball machines, there were no flippers or bumpers that propelled the game around. Basically, you launched the ball, and after that, it was pretty much gravity pulling the ball down.
As a result, players had little control over the game's outcome. To enforce the crackdown, LaGuardia led a crusade to destroy every machine in the city. He was even photographed destroying a 1936 Ballybumper pinball machine, just like the one at the Pacific Pinball Museum. But even though the game evolved over the years to include flippers and require real skill, it never escaped its illicit reputation.
Because of the bans implemented by LaGuardia, public opinion had been swayed to believe that pinball was a game for gangsters.
One day, Sharp hears the familiar sounds of his beloved game emanating from within a building. When he goes inside, he finds an illegal pinball machine.
Even though this ban was in place, pinball was still happening in speakeasies and secret locations throughout the city. Roger Sharp found these places and played pinball wherever he could.
Sharp earns a name for himself as one of the premier players in the city. But pinball stays underground for years. Then, in the mid-70s, a series of events slowly brings it out of the shadows. In 1975, a movie adaptation of The Who's rock opera, Tommy, which centers around a pinball wizard's rise to fame, is released in theaters.
Tommy created a surge in pinball's popularity.
And in 1976, with the game on the minds of people across the country, the coin-operated amusement industry sets out to finally overturn the New York City ban. With Sharp's skills as a pinball player widely known, they turn to him for help.
The industry actually recruited Roger Sharp to take this ban on pinball head-on.
Gaming executives want him to expose the lingering misconception about pinball, that it is nothing more than a game of chance. And to showcase his abilities, they arrange a very public demonstration.
Roger Sharp was to go and play pinball in front of the city council.
But he's thrown an unexpected curveball.
The city council brought in a pinball machine, one that he had never played before. Roger was a little shaken by that because he'd never played the machine before, and it does require practice.
As the demonstration gets underway, Sharp fails to keep the ball in play.
Roger struggled with this new machine.
With the game slipping out of his control, Sharp makes a bold gamble, channeling the spirit of a famous sports hero.
Much like Babe Ruth, he called a shot, which is something you hardly ever do in pinball.
Sharp points to the pinball machine, and with all eyes watching, he goes for broke. Across the top of the playing field are five lanes. He confidently declares that he will launch the ball and aim it right through one of them.
He knew that everything was going to rest on this decision. He pulled the ball shooter back and launched the ball.
In an instant, the ball shoots to the top of the playing field, bounces twice, and goes right down the lane.
Went exactly where he said it was going to go. At that point, the city council all came into agreement that it was a game of skill.
New York City's pinball ban is lifted immediately, and Roger Sharp's called shot becomes the stuff of pinball legend.
That one gutsy move pretty much saved pinball.
After his historic game, Sharp becomes one of pinball's most famous figures and even designs machines for top manufacturers. And pinball, lifted out of the shadows, enjoys a resurgence in New York City. Today, this machine at the Pacific Pinball Museum represents an unusual ban and the daring stunt that rescued an arcade classic. London, England first emerged as a bustling Roman trade hub in the second century and has been a center of commerce ever since. And celebrating its history from ancient times to the present day is the Museum of London. Its collection includes the skull of an extinct ox, a model of Shakespeare's Rose Theatre, and the Lord Mayor of London's coach, originally built in 1757. But stored in the museum's archives is an artifact that seems no more significant than rolled up paper.
It's about 21 inches long and about an inch and a half wide. It's kind of pipe-shaped and soaked in wax to make it flammable.
As curator Jen Cavanaugh attests, items like this played a leading role in one of the city's greatest disasters.
This object doesn't really look like very much, but in fact it reveals a really interesting story about quite a horrible time in London's history.
How is this object connected to one of London's darkest days? December 1952, London. This capital city finds itself gripped by uncharacteristically frigid temperatures.
London had been going through a period of a really extreme winter, which is quite unusual for the city.
And on the afternoon of December 5th, the weather takes an even stranger turn.
It got sort of more hazy and there was a kind of veil of fog that covered the city.
At first, it appears to be a typical case of smog.
It was quite normal in London for pollution to be quite bad, but as the day wore on, the fog got thicker and thicker.
Famous landmarks like Big Ben and Tower Bridge are soon shrouded in haze, and the fog takes on a particularly pungent characteristic.
It's starting to smell, sort of eggy-like smell. It's pretty disgusting, really. Nobody really wants to go outside.
Those who do find the haze so thick that they have to feel their way around with their hands.
People were saying that they couldn't even see their feet through it. It was absolutely horrible.
As the evening rush hour begins, the fog is so thick that traffic slows to a crawl.
Because the visibility was so low, the travel situation in London was really dangerous.
To help the city's iconic red double-decker buses safely navigate the congested streets, police officers use long stick flares, like this one, in the archives of the Museum of London.
They would light it and they would walk in front of the bus with this bright light, which would allow the driver to see where they were going. It was complete chaos.
The noxious smog grips the city for days and shows no sign of dissipating.
It just continues to get worse and worse. It just doesn't seem to be clearing at all.
Finally, on December 9th, after 5 days of horrific conditions, a wind sweeps the fog out of the city. The strange event becomes known as the Great Smog. But as life returns to normal, many residents experience ailments like bronchitis and pneumonia, often with tragic consequences.
About 4,000 people died as a result of this smog.
In the following months, an additional 8,000 people die from respiratory issues. it's the worst air pollution disaster in London's history. Reeling from the tragedy, an outraged public demands answers. But city officials are unable to give any.
The British government just assumed that this was a complete freak accident.
But one member of parliament, Sir Gerald Nabarro, is determined to solve this mystery. Eventually, a committee headed by Nabarro determines that the smog was caused by a weather phenomenon known as an anticyclone. An anticyclone occurs when a high-pressure system settles over a region, trapping air in place.
Because of the anticyclone, air was being forced downwards rather than upwards, and so there was a cold layer of air at surface level.
The effect created London's unusual cold spell, and as citizens tried to keep warm, they shoveled large amounts of coal into their fireplaces, sending plumes of pollution into the atmosphere. Under normal conditions, this smoke would rise and disperse, but because of the anticyclone, the smoke remained trapped.
It essentially was making this nice blanket of smog across all of the city.
But what made it so deadly? The low-grade coal used for heating homes in England contained high amounts of sulfur, a noxious chemical known for its rotten egg-like smell.
Sulfur is really, really toxic. It's a horrible, horrible chemical.
The Great Smog of 1952 becomes a major turning point in British environmental history. In 1956, Parliament passes the Clean Air Act, an historic bill limiting air pollution in London for the first time.
The Clean Air Act greatly improved the conditions in London, and that's continued to this day.
London has yet to experience smog of a similar magnitude again. And today, this flare at the Museum of London harkens back to a legendary environmental catastrophe that plunged a city into darkness. Hastings, Nebraska is located near the geographic center of the United States, a trait that made it the perfect site of the nation's largest World War II munitions plant, since it was out of reach of German and Japanese bombers. Today, the city's history is showcased at the Hastings Museum. Its displays include taxidermied whooping cranes, prehistoric fish, and a collection of antique cars and coaches. But there's one item here that looks like it's sold at the snack bar.
It is 3 inches wide, 4 inches long, and it has a picture of a smiling pitcher.
According to author Marv Rudolph, this vintage packet contains a popular refreshment. But an accidental chain of events transformed its contents into an amazing, crackling treat.
This wrapper tells an unexpected story of America's most revolutionary candy.
How did an iconic beverage give rise to one of pop culture's most explosive snacks? 1953, Hoboken, New Jersey. Bill Mitchell is a chemist at General Foods, a company that has single-handedly changed American eating habits with everything from TV dinners to cake mixes.
You would see General Foods in the cereal aisle. You would see them in the frozen foods aisle. They were all over the supermarket.
Mitchell has developed some of the company's biggest hits, like Jell-O Instant Pudding and Cool Whip.
Bill Mitchell was an inventor to the nth degree. He saw things differently.
But now, executives want him to create his most innovative product yet, a carbonated version of the company's famous instant beverage, Kool-Aid.
Kool-Aid's big drawback was the fact that it was not carbonated. It was not like Coke or Pepsi. He had to create a product that would effervesce, that would form carbon dioxide bubbles. That was the major challenge.
Mitchell tries various methods for making an instant carbonated drink, such as freezing carbonated water, then covering the ice with flavored syrup.
When you added this product to water, it would bubble, and the carbon dioxide would be instantly released.
But when a version is released to the public, having to keep it frozen hardly makes it as convenient as Kool-Aid.
It was a dud, and the consumer was not very happy.
Mitchell heads back to the drawing board. The chemist experiments with adding carbon dioxide to a sugar-based mix. As he cools it down to let it solidify, it cracks into tiny glass-like pebbles. But when he puts them in water, it doesn't achieve the desired effect.
It would sizzle, but it wouldn't deliver the amount of carbon dioxide gas that you needed for a really refreshing experience of carbonated soda.
Then a strange idea crosses Mitchell's mind. He decides to taste the pebbles themselves. And when he pops a few in his mouth, he's blown away.
When he tasted the little rocks, they literally exploded in his mouth.
The crackling sensation is unlike anything Mitchell has experienced before. The chemist switches his focus from soda to sweets. And he gives his confection an era-appropriate name.
This was the great time period of atomic bombs and atomic testing. So atomic candy was the name that he gave it.
But when he shows it to company executives, they see it as a silly distraction from Mitchell's original task and refuse to add it to their product line.
General Foods was not in the candy business.
Mitchell is crushed. For years, few at General Foods give atomic candy another thought. But a new development eventually offers Mitchell a second shot. In the 1970s, General Foods takes over a snack food company led by an executive named Herman Neff. And when Mitchell gives him a sample of atomic candy, Neff instantly sees its appeal.
He thought this was the greatest product he has ever seen. It was so unique. He thought that kids would love it.
Neff says he can make atomic candy a hit, but he declares its Cold War-inspired name is outdated. After polling a group of children, he picks a perfectly descriptive new name, Pop Rocks.
The candy looks like little rocks, and they popped.
Neff convinces General Foods to produce Pop Rocks on a commercial scale. To prevent the candy from being exposed to moisture, General Foods packages Pop Rocks in the same airtight packets it already uses for Kool-Aid. All that changes is the logo on the outside.
Looking at a Kool-Aid packet, I would say that's the grandfather of Pop Rocks, that Kool-Aid was the reason that Pop Rocks were invented.
In 1975, General Foods releases Pop Rocks to the public, borrowing another characteristic from the drink that inspired it.
The three top flavors of Kool-Aid were orange, grape, and cherry. So let's make Pop Rocks in orange, grape, and cherry flavors.
500 million packages are sold in just 3 years.
Pop Rocks were a phenomenon. They were a huge success.
To this day, Pop Rocks are one of the world's most beloved candies. And this vintage 1970s-era Kool-Aid packet at the Hastings Museum recalls the unique origins of a truly explosive treat. From a pinball wizard to an explosive candy, a deadly smog to an underwater escape.
I'm Don Wildman, and these are the mysteries at the museum.
Ready? Okay. Give me a beach.
Beach!
Give me great food.
Tacos!
Give me adventure.
Hiking!
Give me a date night.
Sunset cruise!
Give me some smiles.
Cheese!
Give me more beaches.
Beaches!
What's that spell?
San Diego!
If you're happy and you know it, San Diego is the place to show it. Book your trip at sandiego.org. Funded in part with the City of San Diego Tourism Marketing District Assessment Funds.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers. With rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's Stamps.com. Code PROGRAM.